This is the podcast of the Lead Centre for Dante Studies. I'm Matthew Traherne, and I'm delighted to introduce the second of our conversations on Dante, exploring some of the diverse projects around the world that are changing how we understand Dante, his life, his works, his context, and the role that Dante has played in the cultures of the world. In this second episode, I'm going to be talking about questions relating to how Dante has been translated, how he's been mediated across diverse cultures around the world, including through modern technologies. And in this conversation, I'm joined by Jacob Blakesley, my colleague at Leeds. Jacob is Associate Professor in Literary Translation at the University of Leeds, and he's also co-director of the Leeds Centre for Dante Studies. I find Jacob's work absolutely fascinating. Jacob is a literary translator in his own right. He's produced some absolutely stunning translations of modern poetry. So he brings to the study of Dante and translation that sort of sensitivity to the complex technical decisions that translators have to make when they're translating Dante. But Jacob also has an interest in the bigger picture trends that are shaping the ways in which Dante is being translated and mediated across linguistic and cultural barriers. And so in our conversation today, Jacob will be talking a bit about the global patterns in terms of where Dante is being translated and by whom. Jacob also has an interest in the ways in which technology is helping to mediate the reception of Dante around the world. And so towards the end of our conversation, we discuss Jacob's recent work on Wikipedia, where Jacob is asking what the patterns of Wikipedia entries and access to Wikipedia pages on Dante can tell us about Dante's place as a poet in world literature. I really enjoyed talking to Jacob about his work. You get a great sense of Jacob's enthusiasm for translation as a way of thinking about Dante and as a way of opening up new questions, in particular about the way in which Dante should be seen as a world poet, his place in the canon. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Jacob as much as I did. Jacob, it's really good to speak today.
Thanks so much, Matthew, for inviting me.
I'm speaking from Leeds. Jacob is currently in his family home in Rome. Jacob, I wondered if maybe we could start a little bit by talking about your work on translation in relation to Dante. Would you be able to maybe describe your approach to the study of translation, what the big questions are that you've been interested in and how you've approached them?
So I come to Dante translation not as a Dante scholar per se, but as somebody who specialized above all in modern poetry translations between Italian and English, along with French and Spanish. But I've always had a long-abiding interest in Dante, and I'm coming to Dante from the point of view of a translation scholar who's looking at both the methods and approaches that different translators have used in different settings and languages while translating Dante, as well as more general patterns of translations of Dante in different cultural contexts, looking at cultural influence through how many translations of the Divine Comedy and how many countries, when, and more the sociological trends like that.
You say you're interested in translation across Italian, Spanish, French, English. It'd be interesting just briefly to get a sense of kind of how you came to this area of study. What got you into this kind of research?
Well, in my PhD, I studied modern Italian poets who translated from a variety of different languages into Italian, composing their own anthologies of poetic translations. After that, I worked on a project at Leeds as a Olivia Hume Early Career Fellow, looking at from a sociological point of view, the translation flows and trends between English, French, and Italian poet translators. So I'm interested both in the larger questions about censorship and the changes in poetics and how that affects translators' choice of text to translate, as well as topics like the gender of translators, which we might get to later on, as well as the micro level. Well, did a translator use Terzerima to translate the Divine Comedy or prose translations or free verse, blank verse? What does this mean? And why did the translator choose a specific poetic form like that for his or her translation? And this is all, I think, from a certain perspective, I try to situate it within the canon of world literature. So looking at canons of literature and seeing where Dante fits in and where he doesn't, because my more recent research has studied questions of canonicity, and through looking at published translations, we can see how authors become canonized, lose canonicity in different literary and cultural contexts.
Thank you. That's all incredibly interesting, and I think the way you bring together so many different aspects of translation, whether it's the kind of practical aspects of it or the technical decisions of the translators, together with these bigger trends and bigger questions, whether it's about social questions or about the canon, it provides such rich terrain. I guess, often when you talk to people who have an interest in Dante, one of the things that attracts them to Dante is the fact that his work kind of incorporates all of these questions in quite sharp ways. Could you tell us a little bit then about how Dante fits with all of this?
I mean, if you ask a Dante scholar, well, where is Dante, most translated? I don't think you'd be able to find many responses, because scholars don't know that we don't have a bibliography of Dante translations that's comprehensive and that covers all translations published in the world. So I've been working on one, which I haven't finished, but which has enabled me to discover that he's been translated, that his Divine Comedy has been translated into almost 100 different languages, more than we thought, stretching from European languages to East Asian, South Asian, Middle Eastern languages, a whole bunch of Italian dialects. Whereas, for example, I've been able to demonstrate that there haven't been any translations into any indigenous African languages, which means that Dante circulates in Africa in French, in English, in Arabic, but not in native languages. And so I think that's quite important, because it reflects the fact that our idea of the Western canon is really, the Western is explicitly states that it doesn't apply. There is no global canon, because Dante is not at the center of any indigenous African literary tradition.
Right.
Which there are also many scholars who have an essentialist view of the canon that think that Dante is, the center of the world canon, when he's really not. And so I think that's important to realize, and we can see that through these statistics.
Yeah, and I suppose it certainly destabilizes any idea we have of Dante as a kind of universal poet or as a world poet, even just that fact, that you haven't been able to find any translations into these large groups of languages is incredibly important, just that insight on its own.
Yeah, I mean, if we think there's 7,000 languages and Dante's been translated into almost 100, but that leaves 6,900 languages, and obviously into which the Divine Comedy has not been translated. So what does that say then about the literary canonicity of Dante, globally speaking?
And just to get a sense of, I suppose, your life as a researcher, Jacob, I mean, I know that among other things, you are a translator in your own right. You're a literary translator. You've translated poetry. So part of your research life is presumably shaped by the actual doing of the translation. You're also thinking about big questions about, quite theoretically informed questions about the canon, questions about the sort of sociology of translation, but also doing things like putting together an inventory of existing translations. I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of, how do you go about doing that, putting together an inventory of translations, figuring out which languages do and don't have translations? What methods did you use to get to that point?
It's been quite taxing, and because basically it's a question of looking in different sources. So whether it's the Italian National Bibliography, the OPAC SPN system, WorldCat, which is a database of over 17,000 libraries worldwide, Google Books, but there isn't a single resource that unfortunately would provide the results, and so that's why I'm still finishing up the database, because while I've been able to basically get the data for about 80 or so different languages, I still need to go through another 10 languages, Chinese or Russian or Spanish, which have numerous translations. So it's quite time consuming. And of course, there's the question of, well, do you include a revised translation as translation? So there are terminological questions as well that pose difficulties.
And then when you turn to those languages where there's quite a flourishing tradition, even an industry in some cases, of Dante translations, would you be able to say a little bit about that? I mean, you know, there are so many translations coming out in English, you know, pretty much every year. What light can you shed on that? You know, what's driving these continued new translations in languages where there's already an established kind of corpus of translations?
It's a very good question. I think from one point of view, it's sort of like an avalanche. So the more, you know, you have, the more translations you get, the more popular in certain countries the author becomes. And when you have the case of Dante, who is so innovative on numerous levels, I think poets especially like retranslating him. So there have been more than a dozen translations by English language poets over the centuries. I mean, it's curious that English is not the first language into which Dante was published. I mean, the first translation of the Divine Comedy, a complete translation, was into French at the end of the 16th century. German was second in the 18th century, and then English at the beginning of the 19th century had its complete translation. But I mean, there have been over 60 complete translations into English over two centuries, and it really is snowballing, I think, just as you were indicating. And I don't see that necessarily stopping, although if we look at the gender of the English language translators, we find that they're almost all male translators, so 90 to 95%. This isn't a trend that's somehow gotten better over the recent past either. The first translation of a canticle into English was in 1782, but the first woman translator only translated 80 years later, Claudia Hamilton Ramsay. And if we think of the last translation that really sold by a female translator, we think of Dorothy Sayers and Barbara Reynolds' combined translation in the beginning of the 1960s. It was published. And since then, there have been over 25 complete commedias translated by male translators and only one single author by a female translator. So there's a huge gender disparity and gap, unfortunately, in the realm of Dante studies. And it would be interesting to see if this is worldwide as well. My suspicion is yes.
And is that particularly acute in relation to Dante himself? I mean, is that different for different poets, or is Dante kind of typical?
Yeah, I think Dante is typical. Then a couple of scholars, Sheila Schwartz in particular, who's looked, for example, at Italian, modern Italian poets and Swedish, and found that it was only once modern Italian poets became less canonical and less prestigious in Sweden that they would then become translated by female translators. So men were unwilling to give up, as it were, the authority to translate canonized authors. And my own work has also shown that with regard to Nobel Prize winning authors, who, if we look at a corpus of male and female poet translators, it's always been the male poet translators who have the vast majority of translations of Nobel Prize winning authors. So there's a real entrenched difficulty and bias really at work.
And do you have any thoughts on the, you know, the implications of this bias in terms of how Dante is received and read?
I mean, if we think about what scholars are now doing with regards to translating Homer and Odyssey from a feminist perspective, I think that translating Dante from a feminist perspective, which some female translators might adopt, could pose really fascinating new interpretative challenges. So, I mean, the core relationship of Dante and Beatrice is viewed so often just from the male perspective of of Dante. So what about if, I mean, especially in other works as well, like La Vita Nuova, if it's being translated by a female translator, might have a different sensibility and a different idea of what Dante is getting at.
Well, it's interesting also that the idea of the female voice in Dante is starting to get, you know, more attention in Dante studies as well. The idea that, you know, one of the big changes from the Vita Nuova to the comedy is that Beatrice actually speaks and speaks a lot in the comedy. And even, you know, Barolini's, Teodor Linda Barolini's reading of the Francesca episode, where for all Francesca speaks in, you know, certain kind of lyrical cliches and Dante wants to problematize her speech in all sorts of ways, nonetheless, she's given a voice. So it's really interesting to set those considerations alongside the way in which the reception of Dante in non-Italian speaking contexts is being skewed perhaps by the imbalance in terms of the translators.
Yes, yeah, I would expect they would go hand in hand, the new translations by female scholars and female translators, and then new interpretations as well.
As a translator yourself, Jacob, have you tried your hand at translating any Dante? Have you ever been tempted to do that?
No, I've always been turned off by the Terzerima because I know it's something that I would never be able to to replicate. And so I think that if I were to translate Dante, it would have to be into some sort of free verse, which is, I mean, from a certain point of view, is a failure to begin with. But so, no, I haven't. I've attempted, but I've never tried.
You mentioned translation into languages, the languages of the Middle East and also East Asia. What are you finding there?
Okay, well, compared to European languages, it was really only in the 20th and 21st century that there have been translations of the Divine Comedy into East Asian, South Asian, Middle Eastern languages. So during the first, between the two world wars were the first translations of the whole Divine Comedy into non-European languages, so into Arabic and Turkish. We had to wait to post-World War II to find translations of the comedy into Chinese, Hebrew, Korean, Persian, Urdu, Vietnamese. Recently, there's been a new translation into Tamil and Bengali as well. So there is a clear difference in historical spread of the comedy between Europe and the non-European world.
And in terms of actually studying these translations, I know you know Chinese pretty well.
I wish a little bit, not very
a little bit. Well, nonetheless, a bit, but seemingly for many of these languages, you're having to study the translations at second hand at a remove.
Absolutely, yes.
But are you able to say anything about the translation strategies that are being adopted there? Are there differences that you're seeing?
Well, I've been able to, drawing on secondary scholarship, see how Dante's Divine Comedy, especially the Inferno, has been censored in Arabic and Persian translations. Really important, I think, to give an Anglophone reader an idea of, well, what's happening in other environments where Christianity is not the, Catholicism is not the main religion. So, for example, there have been basically three different strategies that I've seen in the work by Jeffrey Einboden, who studied Arabic translations. So Hassan Utman, who was an Egyptian translator in his 1969 version of the comedy, well, there's the Canto 28 from Inferno, which is with Muhammad, where he's disemboweled for being a sower of schism and a leader of a heretical faith, according to Dante. So Hassan Utman excises the passage completely, so eliminating Muhammad from that canto. And then he adds footnotes elsewhere in the comedy, speaking of Catholic dogma to make it clear to his predominantly Muslim readership that this is a particular theological dogma.
So the Muhammad episode is just removed altogether? There's no mention of it?
Yes, that particular passage. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And meanwhile, in the Persian context in Iran, Shoajin Shafa, who translated Dante about a decade earlier, so in the 1950s, rather than omitting the passage entirely, simply got rid of the proper name of Muhammad and just the pronoun he. So you would have no idea, of course, who Dante was referring to unless you read the Italian. I don't believe that there's a footnote there that says it's Muhammad. Mm. And so whereas Hassan Uthman in his Egyptian, in his Arabic version that we were just talking about, got rid of the whole passage, a different translator, this time from Persian, like Shafa, Faridah David Amghani, who translated just in 2000 the Divine Comedy to Persian, wrote that my hand couldn't translate some verses of that canto, so explicitly referring to that passage. So it was really self-censorship that is going on here, rather than an institutional censorship or fear that her translation wouldn't be published.
And it's interesting to see also the translator, I suppose, actually highlighting the fact that censorship has happened, not just sort of eliding it or moving over it without mentioning it, but actually saying that there is a moment here which cannot be translated, or which I cannot write. Yeah. And then in East Asian languages, what are the main sort of milestones, I suppose, in the reception of Dante there through translation?
Oh, well, that's actually a place I haven't been able to work yet. So I'm still cataloging the different Chinese Mandarin Chinese translations. So at this moment, I mean, there are a lot, but I haven't been able yet to analyze them with the help of secondary research, because I wouldn't be able to read them in Chinese.
Okay, so we watch that space with great interest.
But it's interesting I don't know if we want to move on to the censorship in the English language context or...
Oh, yeah, that would be great to hear about, yeah.
Just because it's quite different. I mean, it's from a certain point of view, it's less important ideologically. So... Eduardo Carrizo-Fulli has studied this extensively in Carey's translation from 1814. Carey was, of course, the translator of Dante par excellence in the 19th century, buried in Westminster Abbey. And so where Dante speaks of the line, un col capo si di merda lordo, or one with a head so dirty with shit, Carey tones it down to, I marked one with his head so grimed. So
right.
Merda becomes grime. When Dante explicitly speaks of farting or trumping, Elli avea del cu fatto trombetta. So he made a trumpet out of his ass. And dove si trulla, so where one farts. Carey merely refers to sound obscene in the hinder passage. And another 19th century translator, Carlyle, basically got rid of the anatomy entirely and just wrote, and he of his had made a trumpet. So just getting rid of, that's very clear censorship there. And just to give you an idea of what now current translators might do, Burke and Sanders in the 21st century translated this as, the chief ripped a huge fart and salute as they went. So you can see a huge linguistic register discrepancy between 19th and 21st century translation English.
Well, it's interesting that, as you know, you can see that Dante himself, when he's making these gestures, his kind of willingness to adopt multiple registers is in itself part of the kind of the shock value of the comedy as he's writing it. And I guess, as so often is the case with translation, there's a sort of conservatism that can kick in at times. Whereas now, of course, I think people would be much less shocked by the idea of, you know, farting and shit in a poem. And I mean, we've been talking almost entirely about the comedy. Is that the case, that, you know, the overwhelming majority of interest from translators is towards the comedy? Are you able to study a little bit what's happening with the other works?
Yeah, I mean, compared to the 60 plus complete versions of the comedy in English, and then you have to add another 50 to 60 separate and single canticles, whether Inferno, Purgatorio, or
Purgatorio. Right.
So, you know, the Vita Nuova doesn't even have 20 translations. So there's a huge difference there. Yeah.
And I know recently you've been working on a really intriguing project looking at the idea of Dante as a world poet, but taking the lens of Wikipedia.
Yes.
And the Wikipedia entries on Dante. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you've been doing in that?
Sure. So my work on Wikipedia was stimulated by a really interesting article by a group of five scholars, including the theorist Mads Rosendahl-Thompson, who is a theorist of comparative literature. And they had an article called World Literature According to Wikipedia, where they basically show that you can look at page views of certain authors globally in the 300 different Wikipedia editions, which are redacted in 300 different languages, and they look at the readership from the bottom on up, as it were, just people going onto Wikipedia, searching for an author, searching for a work, and then seeing how many times during a specific period of time that author work is accessed, and then comparing those statistics with other authors. So I've done this for Dante, both looking at which of his works are viewed the most across the world, across the 300 different languages of Wikipedia, as well as seeing the popularity, proportionally speaking, based on the amount of people in each language that could conceive that access Wikipedia in that calendar year. So, I mean, my statistics show, for example, that Dante, although there's 309 Wikipedias, he actually only has entries in about 170 of them, which means that in over 130 of them, there's no Dante, there's no Divine Comedy, there's no Inferno. Mm. So that in itself is a sort of pendant and complements what we were talking about earlier about the canonicity of Dante seen through book translations and the absence of Dante from many cultural contexts, which is as well in Wikipedia.
Presumably you're finding similar patterns in terms of the volume of translation activity.
Yes.
And the volume of Wikipedia activity.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's clear that in terms of absolute number of visits, English is actually number one. And that has to do a lot as well with the fact that English is often a gateway for people whose mother tongue is not English, but who look up entries on English Wikipedia since it's so well developed. And then you have, you know, Italian, Spanish, Russian, German, Portuguese, French, Japanese, Polish, and Chinese in that order. But I think it's interesting if we, instead of looking at the absolute number of visits, which can be skewed by the number of people who access Wikipedia through the year, obviously, you know, if there's a billion people whose mother tongue or second language is English, and you compare that to, you know, Iceland with 300 some thousand people, you can't expect that there'll be the same amount of visits
sure.
in a small country. But if you look at the ratio, it actually turns out that it's in, you know, Bosnian, Albanian, Macedonian, and Croatian Wikipedias that there's the most interest in Dante, or at least the most entries accessed in terms of how many, you know, Albanians and Croatians are accessing their Wikipedias each year. So that, you know, these come before the Italian and English Wikipedias. If we do the strict ratio of Dante views divided by the total page views in a Wikipedia edition in the calendar year, not only in languages like Arabic and Persian is Dante more accessed than in English, but even in Mongolian and Tibetan. I think this is really interesting because it shows places that we need to start that we need to study. So why is Dante so popular in Mongolia and Tibet? If we didn't have these statistics, we would never have thought this. I can't speculate at this point. We need somebody with a country-specific expertise to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's so exciting about that project is that it just prompts so many questions, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't give you answers to the questions of why, but it just offers a really interesting mirror onto Dante in the world. And presumably, you know, part of your hope is that it just helps us to ask some different questions.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I guess it'll be interesting, you know, next year, a big anniversary for 2021 for Dante. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with the interest in Dante around the world.
Yes, I hope this will be a real stimulus to further study in a global context of Dante and his works.
And presumably both, I mean, I imagine we should anticipate that, you know, a number of new translations next year.
I hope so, yes.
But also, as Dante is talked about in the context of the anniversary, then, you know, Wikipedia will start to be a place that people are looking.
The Wikipedia data for next year will be very fascinating, I think, once we have it to analyze.
You're giving us, I mean, all sorts of ways to, I guess, to you know, some new lenses for us to think about Dante as a world poet, you know, to ask questions about what that even means, to talk about Dante as a world poet.
Yeah, I mean, because if we think that Dante's, if we think about his absence from the global scene in terms of the lack of translation to so many, you know, countries, and the lack of the absence from Wikipedia, I mean, if we think of countries like, and not only African countries like Botswana or Burundi, but Asian countries like Laos or Sri Lanka, or thinking about more Eastern Asia, Turkmenistan and Tajikistan. I mean, Dante is absent from these Wikipedias. So who occupies that central position that he seems to occupy in numerous Western countries? That's also something to be looked at.
It's great work of decentering, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then, if it's okay, just to go back to you for a moment, Jacob. You've studied Dante in, as far as I know, at least three different national contexts in the US, and then obviously you've researched and worked in the UK, and you also have a home in Italy.
Yes, yeah.
Do you think that perspective gives you, you know, does it make you think, reflect on Dante differently?
Yeah, I mean, I do notice the biggest difference is moving between Italy and then Anglophone countries in terms of the perspectives on Dante and the authority, as it were, of what specific tradition you should be following. And it's clear that there's less interest among certain Italian scholars in Italy of Dante for this sort of approach, I think.
It's got so many new, at least, you know, to my mind, quite new ways of thinking about Dante, and it's throws up all sorts of fascinating questions and challenges. You know, it's challenging to hear some of the things that you've found, whether it's at the level of the kind of the big picture and the sort of global, you know, just the statistics that you've been able to kind of pull together about the global interest in Dante, or whether you're talking about small scale textual strategies. It all prompts and challenges. And I think that's one of the things that those of us who are interested in Dante have to keep on doing, is to kind of, you know, constantly be asking fresh questions and renewing the questions and not becoming complacent in our conclusions. And that ought to be a kind of our common endeavor.
Yes, I totally agree.
All right. So, Jacob, it's been really wonderful to speak. Thank you so much for sharing those insights and those challenges.
Thank you so much, Matthew, for this conversation. It was delightful.
I hope you enjoyed the second of our conversations on Dante. I find Jacob's work a really refreshing and often quite challenging way to rethink some of our key assumptions about Dante and about his place in the world. We've got a number of other conversations lined up over the coming weeks and months, so do please look out for those. And in the meantime, I'd just like to say thank you very much indeed for listening.